investigate?
A career investigatorship of the American Heart Association is really a plum. After I'd been here a couple of years, a chance suggested to me, at that time the NIH had career investigatorships, and he suggested to me that I apply. I said, no, I don't think so. I said, that's too political. I don't think, you never know whether they're going to continue and so on. I said, what I'd really like to have is a career investigatorship for the American Heart Association. Well, that you can't apply for.
And what did you have before the...
Established investigator.
Okay.
That's a five-year thing.
Right.
Okay. Career is for life. That is till you're 65, mm-hmm. till you retire. So I guess he took it seriously because in the year I got it, because he must have put me up for it.
Mm-hmm.
That is a wonderful thing. They don't have it anymore. It's too expensive. They pay your full salary. In addition to that, they pay for one postdoc, and every so often they pay for a senior investigator whom you can invite to your laboratory. And they give you $10,000 a year to do what you like with. You don't have to account for it at all. It's very nice. So I had funds always for one postdoc without applying for it. And every once in a while I could get a senior person. And I did that twice. I got someone from Yugoslavia who was quite an established person, and then I got this man from India who was an associate professor over there. He stayed on, and he decided to stay in this country, and he stayed in my lab longer than he would have if he had had the right kind of visa. You know, he had visa problems.
Right.
Anyhow, he was very productive and a very good... He was an NMR physicist.
Yes, you have a number of papers with him.
Yes. So, but he learned the biochemistry too. I must give him credit for that. So I had that until I was 65, you see.
So then you could also apply for other grants to...
Oh yes. They didn't care about that. Yeah. The only restriction they had is that I had to spend 75% of my time on research. And they came and talked to the vice president for medical research and to the dean and so on, to make sure that they agreed to these conditions.
I see. Did you do much teaching while you were here?
Mm-mm. I didn't do any teaching. The Johnson Foundation didn't teach.
Okay, and then once you had this other...
Well, I got that, I don't know, 63, 64, something like that. So I didn't have to teach all the time I had that. I taught one year after that, after I was no longer on that, which turned out to be a disaster, but that's another story. Anyhow, I got this. This gave me a great deal of independence, you see, because I wasn't dependent on the school for my salary. And look at all these extras that I got. Mm-hmm. It's very nice. Anyhow, it was an organization that treated you as a gentleman and a scholar. It was very nice. The relationship of that organization to the people they supported was very nice.
In 1970, you reported on the EPR spectra of protein-bound manganese 2.
Yeah.
And you've really been unable to do that before.
That's right.
I know there was a report in the literature that somebody had done this with a powdered sample.
That's right.
And you then turned and did it. Can you tell me something about that? Why you were finally successful?
Well, because I didn't realize how anisotropic the spectrum would be in the case of a manganese on protein. The lines come in very different places over a range where I had never looked, and also since there were so many different transitions, you needed a much higher concentration to see it, because it was distributed, the energy changes were distributed. So once I found out that it had been seen, I decided we'd better look for it. And I gave the problem to George Reed, who stayed in the EPR field ever since, by the way, and done very beautiful work.
Where's he now?
He's now at the University of Wisconsin. But he was a full professor here when he left.
I see. He was a student of yours?
No, a postdoc. He's a postdoc of mine. And he stayed on, and he eventually left. They offered him a very good job out there. And he's very happy. He's a Midwesterner to begin with. He got his PhD at Wisconsin. Anyhow, so he did it, and he not only did it, he figured out the theoretical explanation for it. And so it was, I think, a very important piece of work.
But that's sort of a unique occurrence. I mean, you really couldn't use that in general.
Oh, yes, you could.
Oh.
I then looked at, you see, every time I did one of these proton relaxation rates of water, yeah, I also looked at the EPR of the same complex. Most
right.
of those papers.
Okay, but generally you get rather broad.
Oh, it depends. Well, it depends. It depends on the symmetry of the complex and all that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
And but at least we knew how to see it, even if if it was broad.
Yeah.
Now some of them are very sharp, but that's again a question of the structure.
Mm-hmm.
That in itself tells you something, you see. But aside from that, the fact is that we knew now how to look for it, and we could always see manganese proteins after that, because we knew how we had to look for it over a much broader range and enough concentration, if you had broad lines or even if you had narrow lines, but a lot of them, to see it.
By this time, you're beginning to talk in much broader terms. There's one paper that's titled Mapping the Active Sites
yes.
of Phosphor. And I sort of get the impression that you're feeling much more comfortable with all these techniques that you've been developing over all these years.
Well, actually, that mapping of the active sites was due to Jack Lee's thesis. He really set that all up. This was the paramagnetic effect, not on water, but on the atoms of the substrate, you see. And from that, you can get a distance. And you could get distances. If you got enough distances, you see, you could start making a map. Now, unfortunately, there's something wrong with that particular work. He didn't know that there was a complex there that he didn't know the existence of it, you see. I mean, there's nothing wrong with it at the time, but in retrospect, it didn't give the right answers. Now, Al Milvan has done this now for years. He's been mapping active sites by this method. Now, we wrote one paper. There's a paper by Jack Lee and Alan McLaughlin and myself, where we point out all the pitfalls of doing this. And I've never quite convinced Al of the pitfalls, but anyhow.
Where is Milvan?
He's a full professor at Johns Hopkins Biochemistry Department. My postdocs have done very well
yeah.
on the whole.
Appears that.
Yeah. Most of them, the Australian went back to Australia. He was chairman of the Department of Biochemistry at the university there. Most of them, I must say, have done very well.
In 1974, you tackled another new technique. I did at least one paper, and I don't know if you've done others as well, where you used indoor and the nuclear Oberhauser effect.
Oh, yes. Now everybody's using it. It's very easy to do with current instruments. It was very hard to do then. Well, to measure NOEs and so on wasn't easy.
Yeah.
I gave that problem to, Tom James did it in that paper. He was the one who did it. And it had originally been done in Bothner B's lab. Bothner B is at Carnegie Mellon. But with a peptide, not with a protein. This is the first one with an enzyme. But he had done it with a ligand interaction between the peptide and the small molecule. But this was the first one with a protein. And then Tom James tried to do it with others, and it was very difficult, and he didn't get anywhere with it. And when he left here, he told me it was very difficult. Anyhow, When Raoul first came, he was a physicist. I gave him this problem, and he couldn't get anywhere. But it had to do with instrumentation. And now everybody does NOEs. That's how they find out what's near what.
Mm-hmm.
But that was done in the days, in the prehistoric days, for the same purpose.
That's right. Just about that time, you could start doing these cat.
Oh no, that came earlier. That came in the 60s. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that came earlier. But it's all these pulse techniques that make it easy to do these NOE things,
right,
which we didn't have at that time.
Okay. Yes, now you just push a button on the
computer. Exactly.
And it does it.
That's right. But then it was very difficult to do.
Let's see, I have listed here.
Well, we're almost finished, so. Aren't we?
Probably take about another half hour or so.
All right.
You want me to come back?
No, let's finish it.
Okay. Let's see. In paper number 106, you use P31 again. You were looking at P31, but what I thought was a rather cute experiment, in which you used a symmetrical reagent, which then bound unsymmetrically to
that the always appeals to chemists. Yes,
yes.
And broke the symmetry.
That's right, and it.
That is kind of cute.
Yeah, and that told you what about the...
Oh, it told you how it was bound, of course.
Okay.
That the environment of those phosphates, although they're equivalent in solution,
mm-hmm.
is very different on the enzyme.
Okay.
But, and since it is an analog of the two substrates, it showed that one substrate, the reaction that this is an analog for, is two ADPs to give you an ATP and an AMP. It's a dismutation, if you will. And this is one with five phosphates, you see. And the reason that you have to have that fifth phosphate is that if you just made one with four phosphates, all anhydride bonds, it wasn't long enough to reach. So if you make one with the fifth, by the way, I didn't discover that. Someone else did, of course, that the 5-phosphate was a fantastic inhibitor of this enzyme, you see.
Mm-hmm.
And it binds in the places where the two substrates bind. And it showed that one ADP was in a very different environment than the other ADP.
Mm-hmm.
And by the way, what's his name, the very good organic chemist, Leonard Nelson. Out at Illinois. He made the same compound with four phosphates, but he put CH2 groups in.
Oh,
and it worked.
Right, sure.
See? Anyhow, we later proved, this was a paper with Rao, but Rao showed later with the true substrates that the ADPs were very different. One gets magnesium on it, and the other one, no matter how much magnesium is put in there, never gets any on it.
Right. Yes.
And that, you see, is relevant, this experiment, and that tell you more or less the same.
Paired together.
Yes, they complement one another.
Then you sort of return to your foundations, foundations in that you start using the isotope again, and you put in the O18, and it gives you a whole new...
Yes. Well, actually...
Information. How did that...
I'll tell you how it happened. I wanted to know whether one of the enzymes, one of the people in the lab was working with, It was the TUGTP. I wanted to know whether it hydrolyzed the GTP. And I didn't want to go to the trouble of using a mass spec anymore. I didn't have one, and so on and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
So it occurred to me that O17, which is a quadrupole nucleus, that I could follow hydrolysis with O17. So I made some phosphate with O17, and I watched it hydrolyze, and I got all excited. It worked.
You can see the 017 in the NMR.
No, no, no. What you were looking for, I was looking at P31.
Okay.
What happened, you see, if you put 017 on phosphorus, it becomes so broad that you don't see it because of the quadrupole nucleus.
Okay.
So I figured as it got hydrolyzed and then 016 went in there,
right,
the phosphorus signal would rise.
Okay.
And that's exactly what happened. So I got so excited, I called all my postdocs in. There was this fellow, Reuben, who was here from Israel, and George Reed, and I showed them. I said, look, this thing worked. You see, I had this 017. The highest 017 I had, it was only 11%, you see, because 017 is expensive and hard to come by. But I happened to have a sample that was 11%, and I made the phosphate out of it with water. And one of them, I've forgotten which one of the two, said, that line seems to have structure in it. And one of the others said, I wonder if it's an isotope effect. Then I went and looked at this material I had used, this water. I looked at the label. It was 11% 017, but it was about, I've forgotten, 80% 018, you see.
Mm-hmm.
And so I realized that I probably had an 018 shift effect. And so then I dropped that experiment. I made some 018 phosphate without any 017 in it. And I looked at it very carefully, and that's what I saw. I saw I did 50%, so I would see all the species.
Mm-hmm.
You see.
And so then you could easily distinguish
1, 2, 3, 4.
Mm-hmm.
And 5 species.
Yeah. Okay. Number 113 is another one of my favorites, and that's one where you use the ATP beta sulfur.
Beta S.
Beta S, right, yeah. And again, it's almost a classical physical organic experiment.
Mm-hmm.
Was this something that other people were using in the literature? Because you do write an accounts article on it a few years later.
Yeah. What happened was the person who originally synthesized all these thio analogs of ATP is a fellow by the name of Fritz Eckstein in Germany. And Fritz was over here visiting. He published a paper on it, and they had two isomers of ATP beta S and two isomers, stereoisomers, of ATP alpha S. Obviously, the S could be up or down, you know.
Right.
And they had done the NMR on it, and they didn't see any difference. And when he was here, I said, Fritz, I don't believe it. There's got to be a difference between the sulfur, one stereoisomer and the other. I thought, well, it's not very good NMR work. So I had a student on rotation, and she wanted to do something. So I had her do this, and lo and behold, we got a very nice difference between the two stereoisomers. It just took, you know, clean work so that you didn't have broad lines. You can't have any paramagnetic impurities in there. The differences aren't all that great, but they are different. That's how I got interested in the problem. The other reason it interested me is you could buy, AMPS, just the amylate, you know, amylic acid with a bioamylic acid.
Mm-hmm.
And I had the student, just to give her something, the first thing I had her do before she did the other, was to do a titration, a pH titration of AMP and AMPS. And lo and behold, it was really a surprising result. As you go more alkaline, the phosphorus in ordinary phosphate compounds, any of them, as you titrate from acid to alkali, shift is downfield. With AMPS, it's the opposite. It goes upfield, and it's much bigger, the shift.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I have yet to find a theory which explains this, but nevertheless, it was an interesting finding. So I realized that the detailed properties of those two were probably fairly different. And then I got into this question of I was using the ATP beta S, and why we ever did cadmium, I can't remember, but we did, and we reversed the stereospecificity.
Right.
That's why I did that whole series of experiments.
Yeah. I thought your explanation was clever and obviously correct of one just using sulfur, just using oxygen, and the other one being able to bind a sulfur. In the last paper you starred for me was a collaborative effort. And I know you have gone to the Fox Chase Center since you've become Professor Emeritus here. And what is the Fox Chase Center?
It's an institute for cancer research.
I see.
And it has had a very outstanding record of research.
Mm-hmm.
There's some very good people there.
Okay.
And they offered me a job a year before I had to retire from here.
Mm-hmm.
And actually, I had intended retiring, but at that time, my husband was very ill, terminally ill, and I knew it, and I didn't want all the structure in my life to disappear simultaneously. So I took the job. And I agreed to stay there for 3 years. And at the end of 3 years, they certainly wanted me to continue, but I decided I didn't want to.
Okay, so you're no longer there. That's housed where?
It's in northeast Philadelphia.
Okay.
In Fox Chase, as a matter of fact. That's the area. It's called Fox Chase.
That was a... as I say, a collaboration between the group at Fox Chase and Baylor College of Medicine and Argonne National Laboratories. That
yes.
was really...
It was my idea.
Oh, I see. Yeah.
It was my idea, and I sought out someone who had cloned the gene for calmodulin, and that happens to be the people at Baylor.
I see. Okay.
So I sought him out, and I told him what the experiment was I wanted to do, and was he willing to collaborate, and he was.
Mm-hmm.
So then I called Argonne, where I knew Joe Katz very well. Joe Katz had been, many years ago, did a lot of work of growing E. coli in D2O and such matters. And he told me he wasn't working on it anymore, but Henry Crespi, his colleague in that work, was still doing it. So I got hold of Henry Crespi, who, by the way, I've never met yet, only on the telephone.
I see.
And I told him about the problem, and he got excited about it. So that's how it happened.
Oh, I see. And you, they all put together the materials, and you did the measurements on it.
Mm-hmm. Well, they had to turn over the plasmid to Crespi,
mm-hmm.
and he grew the E. coli in the deuterated medium
mm-hmm.
and deuterated substrates, and sent it back to Baylor. They isolated it, the calmodulin, from the bacteria.
Okay.
And then they sent it to us, and we did the measurements.
Okay.
You see, there are certain advantages to being established. If I had been just a fresh postdoc with that
right,
idea,
yeah,
those
yeah,
people
yeah,
probably wouldn't have done it.
They would have ignored you.
Yes.
Yeah, that's true. Well, you know, as in so many cases, the more...
But they were very pleased. They
were bigger and bigger problems.
Yeah.
Because, you know...
They were very pleased with the results that we got.
Good.
Yeah.
You've been very active in both the American Society of Biological Chemists and the ACS. And,
not so much in ACS.
Okay. Well, you did serve once as a division.
Yes, I was also on the executive committee, whatever, the council executive committee of that group, too.
Okay. Yeah. But I don't know how large the biological chemistry division is in the ACS. It may be.
It's fairly large, but, well, it was very disappointing. We gave out prizes, and when I was chairman, the date of the symposium of honoring the prize winners had been changed. And here we had these really fabulous speakers on the symposium, and the audience consisted of the speakers and the members of the executive committee. It was just terrible.
I know that well.
And really, those people weren't used to that. If they had given that same thing at the ASBC, there would have been 1,000 people in the room, that same symposium.
Yeah.
So it was very disappointing.
Your activities in the American Society of Biological Chemists, how did you get involved, and
well,
where you were the first woman president.
That's right. For one thing, I was the first woman on the editorial board of the journal. One of the main activities of this society is to publish the Journal of Biological Chemistry. That's the thing they take more seriously than anything else. In fact, I would say it's 75% of their function. The other function is to hold meetings. And I became an editor in 1958. And as I say, I was the first woman to be an editor. That's when John Etzel became editor-in-chief. Anyhow, it was Corey, I'm sure, who put me on that, because the year before he had been trying me out as a, you know, as a referee. I don't know if you know how that journal works. It doesn't work like the ACS. There's a board of editors, and when the paper comes in, the editor-in-chief decides which member of the editorial board should get the paper. And then that member, that person, decides whether to send it to referees and chooses the referees, you see.
Mm-hmm.
And the member of the editorial board is the one who writes the letter to the author after getting referee comments, if he chooses. He needn't have any referees. And then the editor-in-chief signs the letter, actually. They don't know who wrote the letter, but the editor-in-chief, it goes out under his name.
So as a member of the editorial board, there's actually quite a bit of work to be done.
That's right. I used to get 50 papers a year. In those days, there were 20 people on the editorial board. Today there are over 100.
And they still go through the same process?
They have added another layer. Mm-hmm. They have a group of associate editors who cover certain areas, and they're the ones who decide which editor it should go to, which member of the editorial board.
I see. Okay.
I was asked to be an associate editor. I turned that down because you have to have a very good secretary, or else it's a lot of work, because you have to keep track of the papers and when they were sent out, when they come back. It's not for me.
At some point in life, one doesn't want to do that sort of thing.
No, I was on the editorial board for 10 years.
Yeah. Well, done your work.
Yes, I paid my dues, as they say.
Oh, well. Just one minute.